Today we're talking about the practice of frugality, which is something we don't necessarily always think of in terms of a spiritual discipline. But I think it's something that's hugely relevant for us, especially in today's culture. As I noted earlier, there are disciplines of abstinence and disciplines of engagement. That is something that you do or something that you refrain from doing. Today we're talking specifically about something that we're giving up. And so when we're talking about frugality, we need to be clear what we're talking about. Dallas Willard has a helpful definition to begin with. He says, in frugality, we abstain from using money or goods at our disposal in ways that merely gratify our desires or our hunger for status, glamour, or luxury. And so the whole idea is not spending money on something that we usually could. But I don't think this is enough. I think that there's more to it than that. And the reason is this actually sounds very, very similar to just this secular trend of minimalism that you may be familiar with. There's a handful of proponents. One specific one is Joshua Becker. And on his website, where he is a proponent of minimalism, he says that modern culture has bought into the lie that the good life is found in accumulating things, in possessing as much as possible. They believe that more is better and have inadvertently subscribed to the idea that happiness can be purchased at a department store. But they are wrong. Minimalism brings freedom from the all-consuming passion to possess. It steps off the treadmill of consumerism and dares to seek happiness elsewhere. It values relationships, experiences, and soul care, and in doing so, it finds life. Now, this all sounds great, but there's a point that's missing, and that is, what is the purpose of the frugality? And this is what we want to talk about today, because this is very important for Christians. So when he's talking about minimalism, the idea of buying and owning less, and Joshua Becker argues that it seeks happiness outside of consumerism, right? Now, this is all fine and good, but there's a point that's missing, because what is the purpose of frugality? What is the purpose of minimalism? Well, here it's being happy. It's being fulfilled. It's finding your happiness in relationships and experiences, which are not a bad thing. I much prefer for my kids to not get another plastic toy, but to get an experience, right? That there's value in that. But we're missing something, because what's the point if I don't buy stuff and I just spend all the money on myself and I really enjoy my life and that's it? And so now, I think there are minimalists, and I think Joshua Becker is one of them, who uses minimalism for good. He actually has cut down his budget so that he can give money away. And that's his goal of, if I live on less, I can enjoy giving away all of his money. But that's the thing, right? Because just being frugal doesn't really mean anything. You know, we can clip coupons all day and just have just as greedy of a heart, yeah. Right? We can stockpile our homes full of stuff that was cheap and still be focused on material things. Okay? So the point is not just being frugal, and the point is not just owning less stuff. It has to then, we say, okay, I'm doing this so that I can serve God, so that I can find my dependence on God. And so as Christians, we have to move beyond just, I'm not going to spend as much money, right? That may be a wise practice, right? But that's not the discipline of saying, I'm going to intentionally do this in order to deepen my relationship with God. So the way that I have defined frugality is intentionally saying no to buying things, even if we can afford them or can justify their purchase. Okay, we're not talking about things that are really extravagant or foolish or going into incredible amounts of debt. We're just saying intentionally saying no to buying things for the sake of building our relationship with Christ. So what this means is that we're not talking about general frugality in life. We're not talking about being wise with money. We're not talking about avoiding falling into debt or resisting the urge to keep up with the Joneses. The Bible has a lot to say about that, and those are all really wise principles in life. They fall into the category of what I would call wisdom, which is living life skillfully, living life in a way that makes sense and that is beneficial to you. Now, some people do use the term frugal, even in spiritual discipline, to refer to that. So that's where I'm nuancing this a little bit different. What we're discussing is setting aside a specific period of time in which we're setting limits for ourselves when it comes to our spending habits. It could be a week, it could be a month, it could be a year. You pick, like, for X amount of time, I'm going to curtail my spending habits, and we're going to be really specific. In X, we're going to pick something that we usually spend money on that we're going to say, I'm not going to do that for X amount of time. The goal is not to save more money. The goal is not to pay off debt. The goal is not to have fund your retirement. And it's not even to up your giving percentage. I'm not saying, okay, don't spend money and give it to the church. That's great, but the point here is to say, I'm going to cut back. I'm going to say no to myself for something so that I can focus on what God would have me do. So another way to say it would be saying no to myself so I can say yes to God. That's what we're doing here. We're denying ourselves so that we can say yes to what God has for us. Now, you may be saying, okay, great, I get being frugal, I get being wise with your money, but is that really a spiritual discipline, right? Is that really something that is linked to my spiritual walk? Is that really something that's connected here? Is it realistic or legitimate to assert there's a connection between what I spend my money on and my spiritual walk? And the simple answer is yes, it is. And hopefully I can show you why. So first of all, our spending habits are directly linked to our spiritual walks. And we see this in scripture over and over. In the book of Matthew, one of the most significant passages is Jesus's commands regarding storing up treasures for ourselves. So this is part of his Sermon on the Mount. Jesus is talking about having a different perspective. And he warns people against storing up treasures for themselves on earth. So he says, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Now, many of us are familiar with that passage and that saying. But what's interesting to me is that we often actually treat it as if it's reversed, the saying at the end. So it says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. We often interpret it as where your heart is, there your treasure will be. Okay, let me explain. So we act as if our treasure follows our heart. So if my heart is focused on heavenly things, I will build up treasure in heaven. And if my heart is focused on earthly things, I will build up treasure on earth. That's true, but that's not what he says here. What Jesus is saying is that our hearts follow our treasure. He's saying that whenever we value something, our hearts are going to get tied up in it. And when we build treasure on earth, our hearts are going to be tied to the earth, tied to our treasure. Whatever we build and invest in, our hearts will be tied up in it. Now, I actually find that encouraging because it's far easier for me to change my habits of treasure building than it is for me to change my heart. Because I can say, you know what? I can't trust myself to own that car because I will be mad at I don't actually care about cars. It's a bad analogy. Okay, so I don't trust myself to own this piece of home decor, right? Because I know I will yell at anybody who spills on it. So I can't have that treasure because my heart's going to follow it. I actually had a prof in college who this was true for him. He was single. He had this house. He liked to have students over. He bought a white linen sofa, and he loved it. And college students came to his house and spilled on the sofa. And he realized in that moment he loved the sofa more than he loved the students. And so he said, I can't own that sofa. I have to get rid of that sofa because my treasure, my heart followed my treasure. And I know students are more important, so I need to have a junky sofa. So when they dump soda on it, I don't care. And so that's what Jesus is getting at. Our hearts follow our treasure. So the concern is not change what you value. Don't build up treasure where you don't want your heart to be, because your heart follows your treasure. There's more. If that wasn't reason enough, John, in his first of his letters, he gets really direct about this. John says, do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father is not in them. For everything in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away, but whoever does the will of God lives forever. And John's telling us that everything that comes that makes the world go around, right? Sex, displays of wealth, boastful pride, power, all of those things that are the most significant things in this world, he says those are not from God. They pass away. They have no place in the life of a Christian. And he doesn't just say these things aren't ideal. He says they're incompatible with being a Christian. They're incompatible. You cannot love the world and love the Father. They stand in opposition to each other. And so all of the things that are of this world that we accumulate and then we boast about and we post pictures of and we show off to people and, you know, we invite the neighbors over to see our new stuff and all of that is in opposition to God. Now, it doesn't mean that all stuff is evil, but all of the ways that it ties up our hearts and results in pride and gives us that false sense of security, all of that is of this world and it's not valuable. It's incompatible with the life of a Christian. Now, as if that's not enough, Paul gives strong instructions as well. He's writing to Timothy in the first letter that he wrote to Timothy, 1 Timothy 6:17, and he's giving Timothy commands as to how he should teach people in the church. And he tells Timothy, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Now, side note. There are people who teach that if you follow God, you will be wealthy. That is not true. That is a lie. That is a lie from the devil. God calls people to sacrifice, to give things up, to follow him, and to lay down their lives. Now, some people God gives wealth to, and they're then responsible to deal with that. Some people God does not give wealth to. And some people, and I'm not going to imagine that everybody in this room is great financially in their financial standing, right? Because things happen. Life is rough. There are medical bills that come in that we, you know, for all the best intentions, can't pay. Or something happens with a family member and you have to help them and then your savings are gone, right? And so a lot of times we have this concept of either, on the one hand, God will bless you if you're faithful, or if you have good, sound business practices and you're smart with your money, you will be fine. And if you're not fine, it's because it was your own fault. That's not true, right? And so that is the context. So if when I say the next thing, I want you to understand that there is no judgment of, well, if you're not wealthy, then that's because you didn't do a good job, okay? So just understand that. That is not true. However, most of us in this room, we definitely qualify as the wealthy, right? If you live in the United States, you're already in the top, I don't know, very small percentage. Yeah, it's ridiculous. And then most of us, we live in Dallas, we have jobs, and we move even farther up. Okay, now it doesn't always feel that way when the bills come in, right, and you're paying stuff, but we generally qualify as this. So that means we need to pay attention to this. Okay, that's the point here. So the command is that we are not to be arrogant nor put our hope in wealth, because wealth is uncertain. Now, that's something we can all struggle with, of either thinking, well, yeah, I have wealth because I worked hard and I made wise decisions and I invested. And you know what? That's not true, though. I mean, yes, you may have done those things, but you're not solely responsible for your wealth. Okay. And then the other part is we don't put our hope in that because it can go away in a flash. And some of you know that. Some of you have experienced that, where you had wealth and then one day it was gone. And so that's where he says, put your hope in God, because money can give you a false sense of security where you think you're the reason you have it. And it can also make you think that you should be trusting it and not God. And so he warns us here that we have to be very careful about this. It's very easy to have our money or our possessions make us arrogant and start trusting in ourselves and thinking that we did it all on our own and that God is not involved in that. And in the most all-encompassing statement, Jesus tells his disciples if they wish to follow him, they must be willing to deny themselves, be willing to give it all up to follow him. Matthew 16:24 says, then Jesus said to his disciples, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. Now, it's interesting because we read this and we're like, oh yeah, take up your cross. That means like, you know, work hard and be willing to sacrifice. No, that meant you were going to your death. Taking up your cross was not a figure of speech back when Jesus said this. The only people who took up their cross were criminals who were walking up to go be crucified. So Jesus says, deny yourself and be prepared to die if you want to follow me. Be willing to let it go. Be prepared for it all to be gone because none of that matters. And so Jesus calls us to say that all of these things, all of this stuff in life that is not bad, but we have to be willing to let it go for him. And so what we do with our possessions matters. It affects the state of our souls. If we're tied to our stuff, we're not focused on heaven. Our heart is down here. If we're not willing, if we're saying, okay, I'll follow Jesus, but as long as I can have my house and I'll drive a slightly less nice car, but I'm still going to have a nice car. And as long as my kids can still go to the really good school, and as long as I can still shop where I want to shop. And if that's our deal, I'll follow Christ if, then we're not really following Christ. Because Christ says, be willing to let it all go for me. Now, he doesn't call us all to let it all go. Some people have to do that. Some of us in this room may have to give up everything for Christ. Some of us won't have to, but we have to be willing to let it go. We cannot have our hearts tied to it. So first of all, what we do with our money and stuff matters. It's directly connected to the state of our soul and our walk with Christ. The second reason we need to look into this is because our example, Jesus, who is our example, gave up everything for us. And as our example, we're called to follow that. We see this in 2 Corinthians 8:9, where Paul says, for you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, who that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. And if you were here at church on Sunday, this is exactly what Lucas was talking about. I loved it. I was like, well, that's great. That was perfect preparation for today. Jesus gave up everything. He had absolutely everything beyond anything we can ever comprehend. Jesus had it. It was at his disposal, and it was his birthright. It belonged to him. And yet, he laid it down to come to earth, to live on earth as a human, limited, to breathe, eat, sleep as a human, to teach his disciples, to be arrested, to be tortured, and to be crucified, so that we could be near to God. He gave up his nearness to God so that we could enjoy nearness to God. It was worth it for Jesus to give everything up for the sake of our salvation. And he's the one we're told to follow. He's our example. He's the one we are supposed to image. He's the one who goes before us. He's the one that we are called to imitate. So when we cling to our possessions, when Jesus freely laid down every one of his rights, what does that say about the state of our hearts? If Jesus was able to do that, why aren't we able to give up the very meaningless things that we cling to so often? The third reason is that our lives are not our own. As a Christian, if you are a Christian, your life is not ultimately just about you. And this is something that is very, very uncomfortable for us as Americans, because we believe in freedom. We believe in our rights. We believe in doing the things that we want to do. But 2 Corinthians 5:15 says, he, Jesus, died for all, that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for them and was raised again. So Paul tells us we're not supposed to live for ourselves anymore. You may have all the rights to pursue your own happiness and to do the things you want, but you're not supposed to just engage in those, because we are not called to live for ourselves anymore. Like I said, we're really bad at this as Americans, really bad at this as Texans. And can I say that? I've lived here 13 years now. Am I allowed to claim that now? But we have this concept, right, that, well, self-determination and doing things on your own and working for what you want and achievement and making it happen, those are our values as a society, not laying it down to serve someone else. And so the biblical concept is we don't live for ourselves, we live for Christ. Now, I was always confused by that concept growing up. Like, okay, but what does that mean? And as an American, that's uncomfortable. And but one time in high school, I read something that was really beneficial to kind of illustrate that for me. And so I want to share that quote with you. Now, some of you have as well, but I grew up on the Anne of Green Gables books. I absolutely loved them. They were just, I loved Anne and how she always got into trouble, but everybody loved her. And I thought it was, I had a crush on Gilbert. I mean, it was the whole thing, right? But one of my favorite books was the last one in the series, which is Rilla of Ingleside, and it's about Anne's youngest daughter, Rilla, and as she grows up and matures during World War I. And so it's got a different tenor because it's got the serious topic of the war, and Anne's sons all go off to fight in the war. And so Rilla's at home fighting the war on the home front, and her brother goes off to war, and her closest brother, who's named Walter, he goes off to fight in the war. And he writes her a letter, which arrives at home after news has arrived that he died in France. So she gets a letter from the grave, and he wrote it to her the day before he went over the top. Okay? And so she gets the letter, and she goes and she reads it, knowing that her dear brother has passed away. And he tells her, "I had a premonition that I'm going to die tomorrow. And I want you to know it's okay." And then he says, "I also have something that you need to do. I had a premonition about you too." And he says, "I think that the boy that she was in love with," he said, "I think he's going to come home, and you're going to raise babies, and you're going to live. And when you do, I want you to remember something." And so what Walter says to his sister is, "You will tell your children of the idea we fought and died for. Teach them it must be lived for as well as died for, or else the price paid for it will have been given for naught. This will be part of your work, Rilla. And if you, all you girls back in the homeland, do it, then we who don't come back will know that you have not broken faith with us." Now, there's differences, right? This is human sacrifice and all that. But I think this is the concept here, where he's saying, "I'm going to die for you, but you need to keep the faith. You need to live for what we died for." And this is the idea that your life's person has to change because of the sacrifice of someone else. The idea that when somebody else gives their life for you, it leaves a mark. It changes the course of your life because your life is different because somebody else has laid down their life for you. And that you have a responsibility to remember that, to value that, to continue the work that they died for. And so I think this is the concept that we have here with Paul, but on a much greater scale, right? Christ died for us. If you are a Christian, you know that Christ has paid the penalty that should have been ours, that he died in our place. He took upon himself the burden of sin, and he paid the price for it. And so now, since he has conquered death and risen victorious and full of power, he says, "Don't live for yourself anymore. Live for me who died for you." That is the call that he has placed upon our life. Now, the wonderful thing about it is that the life lived for Christ is the best life that we can live. It's not just the best thing because it leads to eternal life, but it's the one that brings meaning. It's the one that brings purpose. It's the one that brings hope, and that is fulfilling and gratifying in a way that a life lived for ourselves never will be. And so this applies to all of life. If we're to live for Christ, not for ourselves, it applies to everything, which includes, among other things, how we handle our money and our possessions. Because how we spend our money, how we think of our possessions, how we handle those things should be for Christ, not for us. So the question is, what does frugality do? We've said we need to do this, but why? What's the purpose? Okay, I'm supposed to do it because the Bible says so. Great. But what does it accomplish in our lives? Well, first of all, there's a number of things it does. First of all, it reminds us that our stuff really isn't ours anyway. Right? It's not just our money, but our stuff isn't actually ours. It's just on loan from God. It all belongs to him. He created it. It belongs to him ultimately. He's just letting us use some of it for a little while. And practicing frugality, that is intentionally foregoing something that you could afford, you could have, or that you have in your house, helps remind us of the fact, because it breaks our normal shopping habits, right? It breaks our habits, and we start to say, okay, instead of, like, you know, when you go to the store, what are the questions? Well, do I need it? Can I afford it? Is it in the budget? Maybe I can get it next month, not this month, right? These are the questions we go through our minds. Do I already have one of these? Do I remember if it's shoved in the back of my closet? Can I get another cake stand from Target? Because they're only $5, right? In that little section. But what if we asked the question, is this how I should spend God's money right now? Now, that doesn't mean you can't get a cake stand, right? Hospitality, ministering to other people, those are things that God values and that he tells us to do. So there's nothing wrong with having that. But it changes the way we think about it if we say, okay, should I spend God's money on this? It makes me think twice about just cramming my house full of stuff. So we need to, being frugal, being intentionally practicing frugality reminds us our stuff is not really ours anyway. Our money is not really ours. Our stuff is not really ours. Secondly, it helps us better understand the sacrifice of Christ. Now, we will never fully understand the sacrifice that Christ made because none of us are divine. Even if we lay down our lives for somebody else, we're laying down a human life to trade it for heaven. It's not the same as Christ giving up, the God of the universe laying down his life for us. But we can start to get a glimpse of it. Now, many of you know what this is like, because if you've had a child, you've experienced this, right? When you realize that you understand the pain of God sending his son because you have a child, and you can't imagine the devastation of turning your back on your child, right? So there's a sense of deep understanding of the significance of that because of our experiences. And it can be on a small level. When I was in college, Rob and I were dating in college, and he broke up with me, and I was devastated. I was absolutely devastated because I already kind of knew at that point that I would marry him. Like, not that I was going to, but that I would have, right? And he broke up with me, and I didn't know what to do. And I was talking to a professor who was my mentor, and he just wanted to make sure I was okay, that I was processing things okay, you know. And he said, you know, it's a different level, but you now have a better picture of what it was like for Jesus to be betrayed by his friends, for his friends to turn their backs on him and to walk away, to break that relationship. And that was really significant to me because it turned my human pain into something that was holy, of saying, okay, God, it's on a much, much smaller scale, right? But God gave me that pain and it helped me appreciate what he did all that much more. Well, when we practice frugality, it can be the same thing. It's a small picture, but if we intentionally give up something that we could have and choose not to, we get a tiny taste of Jesus giving up what he could have had and chose not to. It's a very small taste, but it helps us better appreciate what God has done because we are participating and trying to follow his example and being willing to give up things that could be or are rightfully ours for others. So, secondly, it can help us better understand the sacrifice of Christ. Third of all, it weakens our connections to our possessions. The less stuff we have, the less that we're attached to, right? If we don't have as much stuff. But it's not just that simple. It's not just have less stuff and you'll be less attached. And this is where Christian frugality is different from secular minimalism. A lot of times, if you've followed any of the minimalist kind of mentality, a lot of times they've said, okay, only have things in your house that you adore, that you just really, really love. And that can be helpful for decorating. Like, don't just buy junk because you feel like you need to have it, right? There's no point in doing that. So that may be helpful as like house decorating or picking out your wardrobe or one of those techniques. But that may be the goal of secular minimalism, but the goal of Christian frugality is to be less concerned with the stuff and more concerned with heaven. And so if following minimalism says, well, this is my favorite vase and it's the only vase I have and I love it with a passion, and then your neighbor that you've invited over because you're trying to witness to her and her kid knocks over the vase, well, we have a problem here because the vase you may love, but it doesn't matter. It's a vase, It's going to burn anyway eventually. So it doesn't matter. And so the goal is to be more concerned with heaven and with people, with spiritual growth, than with stuff. So maybe it means the things you love the most may need to go, because you know that they get in the way. Like my prof with his couch. That had to go because it was getting in the way of the ministry. And so the question is, are my things pushing my soul towards Jesus or away from him? Now, some things are neutral. Like I said, a couch is a couch. But how we use it, how we feel about it, is not neutral. And so we have to ask, are we using the things, and I refer back to our homes a lot, because I think this is where it comes up a lot, especially for women, are we using our homes in a way that honors God or doesn't, right? Am I using my home to just feel really great about myself, to show it off, to brag, or am I using my home to welcome people, to be hospitable to people, to provide a home for people to stay in? Am I using my home, that extra bedroom, for the camp and the city councilors? Am I saying, how can I use my home to serve other people and to glorify God? Or are we just using it to make ourselves look good and to enjoy it ourselves? Intentionally practicing frugality can help us focus our attentions in the right direction so that we're not as connected and tied to our stuff, because we're viewing it in the right perspective. We're looking at the value of things, which is to be used for God's glory, rather than just the value of the fact that I spent a lot of money on something. So it weakens our connection to our possessions. Fourth, when we sacrifice for God, it builds our dependence upon him, because we're saying he's enough. Now, giving up Starbucks for a week is not the same as moving to an impoverished country and risking your life to minister for the gospel, right? Okay, so giving up Starbucks or coffee out is not the same. We're not going to pretend that that's the same level of sacrifice as some other things. But I can tell you, when you forget to make coffee at home because you're used to getting it out, and then you don't get it out, and that caffeine crash hits, right, because you didn't have your caffeine, you still have to learn to depend on God, right? Because you didn't do that thing that you usually do. The other thing is, if we're intentionally practicing frugality and we're giving something up, when the urge comes to spend money, we can use that to point ourselves to God. Of saying, that thing that I was going to buy is not going to bring me peace or joy. It's not ultimately going to bring me happiness, but I know that Christ will. And so taking that urge and saying, I'm going to say no to this, and I'm going to intentionally direct my thoughts towards Christ and say, Christ, I know that that's where I'm going to find my significance and my happiness and my fulfillment and my peace and my joy. And so to pray that God would help you do that and depend less on stuff. So breaking our connection with stuff helps build our dependence on God, because it serves as a reminder of, nope, I don't need that. What I need is more of God in my life. So finding that and then once you go without that and you're okay, then we find that it continues to build that confidence in Christ. So that's number four, that builds our dependence on God. Number five, it teaches us contentment. If you were in the Philippians study last year, you know we talked about this. We talked about Paul's famous statement regarding contentment. He says he's learned the secret of being content in any circumstance, whether he's well-fed or hungry, rich or poor. And the secret is that he can do all of those things. He can be in any of those situations through Christ who strengthens him. That's the secret, is that Christ will give him the strength to be without or to be with, to have or have not. Paul had learned to be content because his focus was on Christ. When Christ was exalted, Paul was thrilled, regardless of what was happening to him. And we're not talking about minor inconveniences, right? Paul was shipwrecked, he was imprisoned, he was beaten, he was arrested unjustly. He rejoiced in prison because Christ was preached. He rejoiced in injustice to himself because Christ was preached. He rejoiced in suffering because Christ was preached. Because for Paul, the only thing that mattered is that Christ was preached. If we can pull ourselves away from all the stuff that we think we need and focus on Christ and him being proclaimed and him changing our lives, then we can learn that contentment, because it's in finding our strength in God, finding God's strength to get us through whatever. The more we practice disciplines like saying no to ourselves, the more we can find our strength in God. And the more we can be like Paul and find that contentment. Number 6, frugality can free up our resources to be used for good. Now, this one's sometimes difficult. We don't really want to not spend our money on ourselves, especially, I find this happens especially if you have a budget system. I'm not down on budget systems. You should have a budget system, okay? But it's very easy, at least for me, right? To be like, okay, but this is my money for the church, and this is mine. This is my money for me. And so my husband and I will break things up, and so we have, you know, the regular budget, and this is all. And then this amount of money is our fun money, right? So I don't have to ask him. He doesn't have to ask me. We spend on whatever we want, and that's great. Well, I get very possessive over my fun money, and to the point that it's interesting, because what we usually find is he spends his fun money, I save my fun money, okay? Because I'm like, if I save it up, I can go buy something bigger, right? And so then I will save it and save it, and then something will come up, and it'll be like, oh, but we could do this. Could we use your fun money? No, that's my fun money. You spent yours. It's not my fault you spent yours. That's mine, and I'm going to hold on to it. Well, good grief. That is not a biblical perspective at all. And so when we recognize that the money is not ours anyway, and we practice saying no to things, we realize that, you know, that little bit of extra money in the budget, that could go to something way more significant that has eternal implications, not another pair of shoes or a book or whatever that I was saving it for, right? When we stop spending money on things we don't need to spend money on, we find that we have resources that are generally freed up. And it might not be that much money. It might be $5 here and $10 there. And there's, I love this idea. I actually saw this on Instagram of somebody who every Friday says, it's Friday, Venmo $5 to your friend and tell him to go buy coffee. Congratulations for finishing another week. And I thought, that's a great idea. And so maybe, you know, it doesn't have to be that I have $200 to give to someone. I could say, you know what, I'm not buying the Starbucks today because I know so-and-so is having a really rough time. I'm going to send her $5 so she can go get the Starbucks. It doesn't have to be much, but saying no to ourselves frees us up to get to bless other people like that. And so it frees up our resources to be used for good and to be used for God. And lastly, it resets our priorities. Remember, we talked about how our lives aren't actually our own. That means our lives shouldn't revolve around us. And even when you have it in the budget that you can, you know, just go browse that dollar section at Target or get yourself a new top, there's nothing wrong with that. But when we break the cycle of, I deserve this because I've worked hard, and we tell ourselves not to indulge in our desires just because, we start to reset our priorities based on what they actually should be. Now, I'm not saying you can't do those things. I'm not saying having nice clothes is a bad thing. But we need to consider those purchases and not just do it because that's what we do and because that's what our culture tells us to do. And our culture says you had a bad day, you should go do some retail therapy. Well, maybe not. Right? Maybe we need to reevaluate and say, no, I'm going to look different than the world because my value is not here. And I don't want my treasure here because I know my heart's going to follow it. I want my treasure in heaven, so I'm going to intentionally use my resources to put treasure in heaven rather than on earth. So it can help reset our priorities. So the question is, how do we practice frugality? Quite simply, the way we are going to do it is my challenge to you is for this week, okay, just this week, start here, set yourself a goal of not buying something that you usually would buy or that you could afford and justify, okay? I'm not talking about, oh, I'm not going to go buy a Ferrari. Great, I did it. Okay. I mean, unless you were planning on it, then that could be your thing, okay? Then you can consider that. But that's not the point. We're not going to say, well, I'm not going to do something crazy. That's not the goal. The goal is to say, I'm not going to do something that I normally would do. I'm going to change my habits here. Intentionally go without something to practice frugality as a spiritual discipline. The point is to go without something we usually wouldn't go without, okay? To leave something in the store that we'd usually purchase. It needs to be something that's really for you. It can't be something you were going to buy for your husband or your roommate or your kids. It needs to be something that was for you, okay? So it's you are giving something up. Don't make your whole family start doing this, okay? They can maybe follow your example, but don't force them into this, okay? So we're going to intentionally give something up. As we do this, there's a couple different things we want to do. First of all, you need to think ahead of time, okay? Don't make this decision in the store or just think, oh, I'll just have it in my head and it'll change my habits in the store. It won't, okay? It's not going to change anything if you wait till you're at the store or you wait till you're shopping or something like that. You have to make a plan ahead of time. So what I would challenge you to do is consider specifically what you're going to give up. And I'll give some examples in a second, but consider what you want to give up before you get to the store. Second of all, ask for conviction on this topic. See what God is prompting you to give up. This is not a habit tip. This is not, you know, one of the points to explain how you can build a habit. But this is significant because you need to see where God's working in your heart. I can't tell you what God wants you to give up, so you need to see if he'll prompt you. Now, he might or might not be clear with you, okay? He might give you a strong conviction. Some of you may already know, yep. Got it. That's what I need to do. Okay. You may have it in your heads already because God's already giving you that conviction. But he might not. He might not tell you exactly what you need to work on. And that's okay. Just pick something. But pray about it and ask God to give you conviction to make it clear what things you may have been prioritizing too highly in your life. Because it's different for all of us. It absolutely is. So spend some time praying about it. Ask God for conviction. Third, write it down. Write down exactly what your goals are. Be specific, state it clearly. This is what's going to help you remember, is if you actually say, okay, not only I'm not just going to spend less, but I'm going to say I'm not going to do X, and I'm going to write it down. I'm going to make that commitment for this week. We're talking about a week, guys. It's not the rest of the year. Some people do this. I'm sure you've heard of this. People go on like a spending ban for a year. But the way that they're successful is they say, okay, I won't buy X, Y, and Z. The exceptions are A, B, and C, but I am allowed to buy these things, right? Because you have to be clear with yourself so that you know what you're doing. So be specific. Fourth, make it personal. Pick something that means something to you. Pick something that's going to feel like a sacrifice. Some of you are like, yes, Starbucks, I don't spend money on that anyway. Well, okay, then don't give up Starbucks, right? Because that's not going to mean anything to you. It's going to look different. We need to know where our hearts are and what things we get tied to. We need to know what are the things that we're tempted to go after that treasure. And it's going to look different. Sometimes it is stuff. Sometimes, especially, I feel like this is especially true for busy women, it's like a moment of quiet, right? So it's, I go to Starbucks or I go to whatever, and I just have my me time. I have a moment. I get the latte. It's a special treat. That may be it then, because that's not necessarily stuff. You consume it and it's gone. But that could be an idol that you're holding on to, this idea that I need to have that special treat because I had a rough day, right? Something like that. Now, I hate to give suggestions because I'm not saying that these things are all bad. I'm not saying that these things are horrible ways to spend money or that you need to give them up, okay? But these are some ideas of places to start if you're struggling. One idea would be not buying coffee out this week. Make it at home. Don't buy it out. Not buying anything extra at Target. But what was on your list? And that's very hard for a lot of us, right? So that could be your discipline, that when I go to the store, I'm only buying the things that are on my list. I will not buy any of those things on impulse. It could be no clothes purchases. It could be skipping a manicure. It could be saying, I'm not going to buy the next book on Kindle just because I finished my other one. I'm going to wait. Okay, so there's a lot of different ways you can do it. I'm not saying manicures are bad. I'm not saying buying impulsively. I've done all of these things, right? They're not inherently bad, but our hearts can get tied up in them. So see where your heart gets tied up and see what things would be significant to you. Lastly, We want to make it obvious. It's really easy to forget in the store because you go into autopilot, right? You go. First of all, none of us intend to go to the store and buy 10 extra things, right? It just happens a lot of times. So there's ways that you can make it really obvious to edit your environment to remind yourself. So for example, some people do things like tape a sticky note to your debit card. So when you pull it out, you go, oh yeah, hang on, I gotta put some stuff back. Okay? It can remind you about the discipline. It could be sitting out a coffee mug next to, you know, on your counter to remind yourself, make coffee before I leave the house today because you're not going to stop today. You can put a note on it, you know, make yourself coffee because otherwise you're going to be cranky because you're not going to get coffee today. It could be deleting your credit card information out of Amazon so that anytime you make a purchase, you have to type it back in. And that, having to go find your wallet, because I don't have my card, they gave me a new card, I don't know it anymore. So you got to go find your wallet, type it in. A lot of times that gives you enough pause that you go, yeah, I don't need this. I'm not gonna do that, okay? So there's different ways that you can do that to remind yourself to take a break and take a pause. Now, like I said, I'm not saying that this has to be forever, but I think there's a lot of value in taking a certain amount of time and saying, for this amount of time, I'm going to change my habits of spending. And a lot of times, it illuminates things to us. It helps us realize, yeah, I've been off on that, or I've been too focused on this. And so taking that time, it's like taking time to fast or taking time to carry out a specific discipline of I'm going to do this every day at such and such time. And so I think it's something that we can revisit. We're going to do it for this week, pick something. And then if you need to revisit this another time of year when this becomes an issue, maybe it's around Christmas, you need to take some time and calm down the spending, because our culture tells us don't do that, right? Cindy and I were just talking about the fact that they decorate the mall for Christmas in, like, I don't know, September now, because they want you to start spending like crazy, like a crazy person in September, right? They want to stretch that out. And so what would it look like for us to push back against that? Especially not just with the goal of saving more money, but of saying, how can I listen to how God wants me to use this? And how do I want to follow him in this? So we're going to take a week, but then I would encourage you, think about if this needs to be something you practice again and you bring it up again. One final note, and then we'll talk about some questions. Going without making purchases for a period of time not only teaches us about ourselves, but it provides us with a chance to refocus that energy that we were going to spend on stuff back where it belongs, which is on Christ. Whenever we feel the urge to buy something rather than just doing it, or rather than what the minimalist would do, which is say, well, learn from your impulses and see if there's an experience that would be better than the stuff, we can use that to point us to what we actually need, right? The person who actually gives us that fulfillment, which is Christ. And so we can use the desire for stuff and the desire to spend money on things to point us back to Christ. And like I said, I think this is particularly relevant for our time and culture because stuff is everywhere. It's never been easier for us to just go spend money and do stuff, right? There's stores on every single corner. You don't have to work hard. You can get it delivered directly to your house. You can drive up to the store. They just load all the junk in the back of your car. And it's never been easier for us to think that stuff and convenience and spending money is the key to happiness. And so the goal here is to break that concept so that we can start to really understand what the Bible teaches about that.